Welcome to the Astro Music Podcast, an affiliate of SyncBook Radio and SyncBookPress.com.
Tonight we're going to be speaking with Gemini Brett, an astrologer of the shamanic astrology tradition and also an incredible musician. Brett and I met a few months back and we really hit it off, and so I was hoping that tonight we could go a little bit into our shared connection between music and astrology. Welcome to the show, Brett.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So, Brett, you do a lot of things. I've seen you've done some videos online, and you clearly are a wealth of knowledge. Can you tell the audience a little bit about what you do?
Sure. I'm a practitioner of shamanic astrology, which is a newer branch of Western astrology, and a bit of a trickster guide for people. I'm very much an astronomer as well, and a mythologist and a musician.
So, as a musician, are you a composer? You also, I believe you play saxophone, is that right?
Yeah, saxophone's my main instrument, and I compose as well. Since astrology's come in, I've definitely played less music than I have in my past, but it'll always be a part of me.
I hear ya. Well, my intention tonight with you is to go through a couple of different spheres of music and historical intrigue. And just to give the audience a little bit of context, I published this book back in April 2014 with the SyncBook Press. It's called Astro Music, and the intention behind this podcast is to bring on astrologers and musicians, occultists, anybody who's studying the Western Hermetic Mystery tradition and applying that to the study of music. So in the book, I describe a lineage of ceremonial magic that came through London in the late 19th century, through a group called the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. And it's a series of correspondences between musical notes and the planets and signs of our particular zodiac. So using that codex, if you will, we're going to be looking at historical dates and the sky charts of those dates and picking out certain sections of the chart to focus on. Since this is the first episode, it was actually kind of a beautiful synchronicity that I got together with a buddy of mine, Michael, just a few weeks ago, and we were playing through the charts that were going to be coming up in the following month. And when we came to around this time, which is October 31st, we noticed that there were a lot of planets in Scorpio. There was actually the Sun, Venus, and Saturn. And those three notes together in the tone color alchemy correspondence system that I use formed the musical notes D, F sharp, and A. And together they create what's called D major chord. So we recognized that that was intrinsically harmonious, and we wanted to see what else might be available in the chart on that day. So we looked at the sign that they were in, which is Scorpio, and D, F sharp, and A over G created a really unique sound. And I was on guitar, Michael was on piano, and after just a moment of improvising, my ear recognized immediately, oh my God, that sounds just like this composition by Brian Eno called Music for Airports. And so we went on for a couple minutes and kept playing through, but then we paused and we brought up on YouTube, we brought up that particular song, and it turns out it was in that same key. So I thought that would be an interesting starting point for us tonight, because that was such a monumental piece, and also because it'll give us sort of an entry into talking about what you're really an expert in, which is the astrology part.
Sounds good.
Great, man. So what I want to do before we begin this conversation is to just play an excerpt of that song for the audience so they can hear it.
Thank you.
Okay, and we're back. So that is Music for Airports. It's by Brian Eno. And that was a composition that was considered to be one of the first, if not the first, piece of music called ambient. That was a genre that had already sort of begun to bubble up to the surface through previous compositions by Eno and other people in that field. But that was the first album where he actually used that term to describe that style of music. And allegedly, it was formed in his mind as a concept while he was waiting at an airport in Germany. And the idea was that he was surrounded by all this sort of chaos, and he could feel how the music was contributing to the sense of anxiety that people had as they were moving through the space. And so he started thinking about what it might sound like if he was going to create a piece of music specially for airports. And that was that piece. So if we look at the chart for the release date of that record, the Music for Airports record, we see that the Sun and Venus once again are together, but this time in the sign of Pisces, and Mercury is hanging out there nearby. So about a week and a half from now, Mercury is going to be entering into Scorpio, and so you would have the same three planets, the Sun, Mercury, and Venus in Scorpio, whereas at the time of the release of Music for Airports, you would see the Sun, Mercury, and Venus in Pisces. So you and I were talking last night briefly, and you pointed out that this composition is very Piscean. It's very ethereal, and it has that sort of open-ended sound. And so to begin our investigation into those planets functioning in Scorpio, we need to kind of adjust our sights. Scorpio is more a sign of death and intensity and perhaps also sexuality. So I thought maybe you'd like to speak to what we're seeing in the charts today, October 31st, and what we can expect to see in the coming days and weeks and months.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd love to bring in the piece about the Venus synodic cycle, which is something that most astrologers don't really look into. And it's something that Daniel Giammario, who's the founder of shamanic astrology, really brought back to the fold. It seems to be something that the ancients were very much keen on. And at that time of the Brian Eno release, Venus was about 9 degrees from the Sun. And when Venus is within 10 degrees to the Sun, she disappears. In a way, she is removed from the world stage. So at times, she's available in the morning sky, and at other times in the evening sky, always close to the Sun, so close to sunrise or close to sunset, because Venus is between Earth and the Sun. But when she gets within 10 degrees, she disappears. And shamanic astrology imagines the ancients would have seen this as Venus descending into the underworld. And there's a time, there's actually two times in her what's called a synodic cycle, and this is talks about the dance between Venus, Earth, and the Sun, where she will make these conjunctions. One is in retrograde, and it's just before the next cycle begins, before what's called her helical rising, when she's first available to be seen in the morning sky. And that heliacal rising happened this year on January 17th, 2014. And then Venus will go direct, and she's slowly chasing the Sun down. It takes her about 8 to 9 months before she catches up, and she gets within 10 degrees, and she descends into the underworld. She disappears. And then she will make exact conjunction with the Sun, and that happened just last week on October 25th. And it was fun for me because typically shamanic astrology has a little bit more of a positive take than well, many astrologers out there, and some of the old ways I like to call the planet police for that reason. But in this case, it's a little bit different because I read a lot of astrologers writing, oh, Venus is love, Scorpio is passion, the Sun is the magnifier, and so this is just the magnification of our passionate love. Let's go for it. But in shamanic astrology, this is Venus in the underworld. In fact, on that day it's of her conjunction, October 25th, it's the day of her shamanic death and rebirth. And we relate this to the Sumerian mythos of the descent of Inanna. Inanna, who is queen of the middle world and of the heavens, and she descends into the underworld to assist her sister Ereshkigal in grieving the loss of her husband. And it's a wonderful story, a very old story that comes to us from the Sumerian tablets. She has to release all these adornments that seem to relate to the chakra system. And by the time she gets in front of Ereshkigal, she's stark naked, and Ereshkigal rewards her for coming to grieve with her by slaying her and hanging her on meat hooks behind the throne. And then she goes to this death and rebirth, and she ascends in the process, retrieving her adornments. And so we say this cycle, the synodic cycle of Venus, which is about 584 days, there's this descent of the goddess, the death and rebirth, and then the ascent. So at this time that many astrologers were saying was this magnification of passionate love, you know, our take is actually this is the goddess in the underworld going through death and rebirth, and especially in Scorpio, which really holds that quality anyway, you know, it's very much magnified. And I'm seeing this, you know, expressed around me in so many ways. Of course, it's not the only aspect that's happening on the chart that speaks to tension or this energy of kind of scorpionic death and rebirth, but it's a major factor. And yeah, the Piscean quality of kind of mystical merging, you know, that Brian Eno song and ambience in general, it's very Piscean, and it's very much about the plane, you know, launching into the skies that connect us all. But where Scorpio would be more about like the plane crash.
Wow. And that brings us to another point that came up last night just organically in our conversation that, you know, it seems to be a recurring theme that these major figures in the music industry will be at the height of their career and will be killed off in a plane crash, either, you know, through accident and poor luck, or perhaps by some form of conspiracy. But either way, there's a famous story of Buddy Holly, who was one of the first major rock and roll stars. Buddy Holly was the lead singer in the band The Crickets, and there's actually a story that says that the Beatles, their original name was the Silver Crickets, and that was a reference to Buddy Holly's band. But anyway, the idea is that Buddy Holly was 22 years old at the time of his death, and he was on tour as part of a three-week promotional event with two other major singers, one of them being Richie Valens. And the three of them were so cold in their touring van that they had decided to just take a private jet to their next location. Also accompanying them was a famous singer at the time. What was his name? I think you had picked up on that yesterday, Brett. What was that? Dion from Dion and the Belmonts.
Right.
And Dion was another sort of male heartthrob teen icon, and he had decided to stay behind. So he actually managed to escape the jaws of death. But Buddy Holly, again, he was 22. He was a young man, and I believe Richie Valens was also young. He was maybe 17. I have the information pulled up here. But anyway, the point being, there's this idea of the plane rising from the airport and crashing, and one of Buddy Holly's big hits was that song, That'll Be the Day That I Die. So I want to play that for the audience quickly so they can get a taste of what his music sounded like.
Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a lie, 'cause that'll be the day when I die. Well, you give me all your loving, all your hugs and kisses and your money too. Well, you know you love me, baby. Still, you tell me maybe that someday, well, I'll be through. Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a lie, 'cause that'll be the day when I die.
Hey, so that's Buddy Holly, and That'll Be the Day That I Die. Interesting thing surrounding Buddy Holly is that he is actually said to have this sort of curse that accompanied him into the future. When the Crickets found out of Buddy's death, they actually decided to bring in this other guy, David Box. And David Box continued to sing a number of songs for them as the frontman. He, too, died in a plane crash at the age of 22. After having been singing Buddy Holly's song. So there was this strange eeriness around it. Anyway, not to dwell on that too much, but it sounds like also that Buddy Holly's wife, when she found out of his death, she miscarried. And so there's this theme of the Empress, which in the tarot corresponds to Venus. that the Empress is sort of going through this death process where her child is dying. And so the idea of the sun connecting to Buddy Holly and Venus connecting to Buddy Holly's wife, the death of the child or this sort of child sacrifice feels very potent.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there was this other synchronicity that I found today after our conversation of this unmanned rocket that exploded shortly after launch a few days ago. I think it was October 28th. It was carrying supplies to the International Space Station, and it was an Antares rocket. Now, Antares is the name for the bright red star that is the heart of the Scorpion constellation. And though that constellation, because of precession of the equinoxes, no longer aligns to the seasonal sign of Scorpio, you know, to me there was a huge synchronicity in this and kind of the explosion and maybe even this kind of even Aquarian nature of reaching for the cosmos that Scorpio doesn't enjoy since it's so much about the authentic experience of the heart. But to bring this back to Venus, yeah, this time of Venus in the underworld, I mean, she will still remain within 10 degrees of the sun until December 4th. And then she's far enough away that we'll see her again in the evening sky. And she rises further and further in the sky along her path. And she's reaching what's called maximum elongation until the cycle begins again next August. And the idea that it's happening in Scorpio now, I mean, there's so much Scorpio energy, as you mentioned, Saturn in Scorpio, it's been there since 2012. It's going to move out into Sagittarius later this year and then retrograde and come back into Scorpio for a little bit more of that action before it moves along finally next year in 2015. Venus in Scorpio, Sun in Scorpio. Mercury was in Scorpio in early October and went retrograde October 4th and dipped back into Libra where it is now, but will move back into Scorpio on, I think it's October 8th. November 8th. And there's a lot of significant planetary happenings right around that time. Mars will conjunct Pluto in Capricorn on the 10th, and Venus will conjunct Saturn in Scorpio on November 12th. But this Venus synodic cycle, it's a very interesting thing. She makes a sacred pentagram in this dance with the Earth around the Sun every 8 years. And it's one of the reasons why the five-pointed star, the five-petaled rose, has been sacred to the feminine and to Venus since age old. And it's an amazing dance. You know, it's very hard to explain without visuals, but I have a video of this up on my website. It's morethanastrology.com. And there's a movies page, and there's a movie called The Venus Synodic Cycle where you can check that out. But it's incredibly Fibonacci. It's very much keyed to the golden number, the golden ratio, because in 8 Earth years, which is 13 Venus years, they make 5 of these kisses, 5 of these interior conjunctions with Venus. So we have the 5, the 8, and the 13, which are, you know, relevant to the Fibonacci sequence and to the golden number. And, you know, with your interest in synchronicity, these numbers of the Fibonacci sequence, you know, 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, we see them everywhere in nature and in the esoteric.
We also see them on the piano, which is something that I covered in the talk on July 3rd, that the piano is divided into 8 notes, which creates the octave, and then the 5 black keys together form a 13-note scale. So that's the 12-note scale plus the return to the octave. So that 8-5-13 sequence of Venus seems to be the basis for this this whole musical system.
Wow, and so you've got the 5-note pentatonic, the 8-note major scale, and together they form 13. That's very interesting.
I'm really interested in all the sort of symbolic codes here that music seems to be so deeply enmeshed. If you look at the early roots of it with astrology, that they literally came out of the same mystery tradition, the idea in the early Greek mysteries of the, you know, the planets as they moved around the sun generating these different musical tones depending on their spin and their orbital period and all of that. And actually, there's a beautiful story about each one of these planets being mounted by these sirens, who were these seductive female spirits. And each planet was sort of ruled by one siren or one spirit, if you will, and they would be riding on top, sort of like children on a carousel. And they would be singing these musical notes perpetually. And if you could actually hear all of those sirens singing their songs simultaneously, then you would hear what they called the harmony of the spheres, which was sort of the symphony of heaven.
Yeah, and it's one thing that I really love about your work, Ezra. You know, this idea of the harmony of the heavenly spheres, to me, it's not just a metaphor, but actually a very scientific description of how astrology is working. You know, when I sit with clients, I'll show them their birth chart. I often show them a picture of the solar system at the time of their birth first, which is a little bit less foreign than the glyphs and the lines on the astrological natal chart. But I show this to them and I say, hey, this is your song. You know, this is the song that you came in hearing. Every planet has a note or a melody. You know, maybe the planets are notes and the signs are melodies. And here is this symphony playing to you, a song that is unique to you and only you. And it's your song for this lifetime, you know, and throughout the life, the song in ways will be challenged or expanded, and there's evolution available to it. But this is the song that you come in with. And when we know more and more that, you know, we are electromagnetic receivers and transmitters, clearly as is the Earth and the Sun and the planets, to me there is really this expression in astro music that is an explanation of how the planetary song, notes, electromagnetic resonance is feeding into that of the Sun, which influences the Earth, and we are tuned to that. Mm.
Beautiful. You know, you had mentioned earlier this Mars-Pluto conjunction that's happening. Is that in Capricorn?
It is in Capricorn, and you know, Capricorn is this very important sign of the times. And I'd love to go there, you know. So basically in shamanic astrology, when we're looking at this 584-day Venus synodic cycle, we say that she's basically investigating the sign that she was reborn in. And again, this happened January 17th this year, and that was in Capricorn. And so we say basically Venus is undergoing the Capricorn investigation and initiation at this time, especially right now. It's the deep initiation part of the cycle. Capricorn is crucial in many ways in this year, 2014. We had Capricorn new moon on New Year's Day. We only have a new moon on New Year's Day every 19 years. It has to do with the lunar standstill cycle of 19 years. And we'll have a second Capricorn moon, which is one of the many definitions of a blue moon, two new moons in the same sign in a year. We'll have the second one on winter solstice. So these very key dates of the solar calendar, New Year's Day, and winter solstice, there's Capricorn new moons. And so I did some research. That's going to happen again in 19 years, but it hasn't happened for a long, long, long time, and it won't happen for a long time again. So Capricorn is this major focus. It's also a major focus because that's the sign that Pluto is slowly spinning through at this time. And the Pluto story is absolutely significant. You know, Pluto is a slow roller, so it's basically 2008 all the way till 2024 where it will spend its time in Capricorn. Actually, the first time that it's moving through Capricorn since Pluto was discovered in 1930, it was in Cancer across the chart at that time. So it's not that it hasn't been in Capricorn before, but this is the first time since Pluto is available to the collective consciousness that it is moving through Capricorn. And Pluto very much is the professor of Scorpio school. It's about the shamanic initiation, about the death and rebirth for the sake of authenticity and evolution. And so Pluto tends to bring evolution to the theme, the archetype of whatever sign that it's moving through during this time that can be anywhere from, well, it's about 15 years. And it can be much longer. Pluto has a very eccentric and strange orbit. For example, when Pluto was moving through Sagittarius, and Sagittarius is so much about truth and the intuitive pursuit of truth and seeking, to me, like the quintessential Pluto and Sagittarius moment was 9/11. You know, this happened with Pluto in Sagittarius. It was aligned to Saturn. That chart's amazing in many, many ways. But here is this moment, this very like shamanic kind of death and rebirth moment that opened the gateway to truth if you had the courage to go into it. And it took me a while to do that, right? So that's kind of what Pluto was doing for Sagittarius. It was like, here's this shamanic initiation for you to open yourself to further truth. And now it's moving through Capricorn. And Capricorn, I feel, while Scorpio actually might be the most betrayed archetype, because it's very much about magic and there's much imagery of the witch who was burned at the stake available in Scorpio. Capricorn is an earth sign. And traditionally, these are seen as feminine signs, yin signs. But Capricorn, in most of the astrology books, is taught as the archetype of the father and the provider and the rule maker and the lawgiver and all this kind of patriarchal stuff, mm-hmm. which is anything but feminine. Mm-hmm. And I really feel that Capricorn is seeking to be returned to its truth and its roots. And the roots are Capricorn's truth. When I look to the tree, Capricorn is the trunk. It is the roots. It is the structure. But it's not this structure of man's law and order, but more of what the Greeks called the themis, divine law and order. And the archetype that shamanic astrology puts forth for Capricorn is the circle of grandmothers. You know, these wise elders intent on preserving earth wisdom for the seven future generations. And in this realm where there's very powerful men and chiefs and warriors and medicine men, whatever, the circle of grandmothers had the right to yank the feathers from the chief's headdress if their decisions did not grow corn, which is to say they did not have the earth in mind, they did not have the seven future generations in mind. And so in the way there's this kind of earth wisdom that has been stripped from us, and Pluto moving through Capricorn, I believe, is this very strong intent to return that wisdom to us. So it's basically like here to destroy all structures that do not serve Earth. And there was a key indicator of this when Pluto first moved into Capricorn to stay in January of 2008. This was global financial crisis. And why? Because this debt-based fiat currency system does not grow corn. You know, it doesn't make sense. It's not healthy structure and one that supports the earth and the seven future generations. And so we're seeing a bunch of that. And in the years 2012 to 2015, Uranus comes in to make a square alignment, a 90 degree alignment to Pluto. This is very rare when they get together in what's called hard aspect. And it's almost like an acceleration of this because Pluto is evolution and Uranus is revolution. So we're at this heightened time of change, and it's part of what's really seeding spiritual awakening in a lot of people. But there's also a lot of pain, you know, and having to release the old and destroy that so we can make room for creation.
And the Mars-Pluto conjunction, are you reading the Mars as a sort of, it's like stoking the fires of Pluto?
Yeah, in ways, although the shamanic astrology imagery of Mars is more kind of on the Jungian image of it as the animus. Mm-hmm. So in the old systems, it's like Venus is love and Mars is like the warrior, go get them, creative force. Shamanic astrology sees them as anima and anima. So Venus is the feminine and Mars is the masculine mm-hmm. in all of our chart. And oftentimes women will associate more with their Venus and project Mars onto others until they find it within, and vice versa for men. So, you know, what's most interesting to me in this dance is that Mars has this synodic cycle too. And so Venus, even though she's in Scorpio now, we say she's undergoing the Capricorn investigation. And this is true for all of us. We all have Venus and Mars on our chart. My Venus is Virgo, but my Virgo Venus was in the midst of the Leo synodic 19-month or 584-day investigation. So even though Venus is in Scorpio now, and eventually she will ingress into Sagittarius and then Capricorn and through the signs, you know, she's holding this kind of intent of Capricorn now. And Mars is doing the same, but in Libra. And from shamanic astrology's imagery, Mars began this new quest on April 8th of 2014. And Mars's cycle is not nearly as harmonic and beautiful as Venus's. And we learn this in alchemy, that the feminine is the fixed and the masculine is the volatile. And that's reflected in their orbits, because Mars's orbit is incredibly eccentric and strange. So it's harder to put your finger on the pulse. But for shamanic astrology, we begin Mars's new cycle after its retrograde period, when it has what's called achronychal rising, which means it rises when the sun sets, and it's kind of as bright as it gets and as close to the Earth as it gets. And that happened on April 8th. And so this is Mars's new quest to study the Libra mysteries. And so this has been really interesting to me. It's like Venus is doing the Capricorn thing, Mars is doing the Libra thing, and especially at this time now with the goddess in the underworld in Scorpio, and we can take it 2 days before her exact conjunction to the sun on October 25th when we had the Scorpio solar eclipse on October 23rd, which happened at 0 degrees 25 minutes Scorpio, so very early in the sign. In fact, Venus moved into Scorpio just hours before that eclipse, and then the sun and the moon followed her and first aligned to Venus, actually occulted Venus, which is like an eclipse, and then eclipsed part of the sun. It wasn't a total eclipse. And a couple days later, this was October 26th, Mars then moved into Capricorn. So it's interesting to me that on the synodic cycles, these longer cycles, Mars, the masculine, is studying Libra. Venus, the feminine, is studying Capricorn. And at this very crucial time, Venus moved from Libra, Mars's kind of sign of study at this time, into Scorpio. And then Mars shortly thereafter moved from Sagittarius into Capricorn, Venus's current study. So there's kind of this exchange program of the signs that they're looking into. And then Mars, as you're saying, will conjunct Pluto. And so this happens every 2 years. I think the last one was November 27th, 2012. And now we're moving into this next Mars-Pluto conjunction. In a way, especially because Pluto is relevant to Scorpio, it very much is the planetary carrier of the Scorpio energy, and Venus is here in Scorpio and doing the kind of death and rebirth thing at this time. Well, I just like the imagery, the archetypal imagery, in a sense that Venus exploring Capricorn is here to retrieve that truth of the circle of grandmothers, like the wise elders who will share their teachings and their wisdom, while Mars is working on the Libra thing, and this is kind of rare, and it's like the masculine energy doing Libra, which is partner, relationship expert, peace, equality, you know, truth, justice, and diplomacy. So in a way, like, the feminine is regaining the opportunity to share her wisdom, and the masculine is growing the ears to hear it. And so I love that imagery, but it's not going to happen, obviously, immediately. And part of the process is this death and rebirth of the goddess in this plutonic, this scorpionic way, while Mars in Libra is also undergoing his labors. And there's something about Mars connecting with Pluto, and especially the relevance of how that's happening in Capricorn while Venus conjuncts Saturn in Scorpio. And that takes this whole Scorpio-Capricorn dance a little bit further, because in the traditional systems, Saturn most represents the sign of Capricorn, mm-hmm. while Pluto most represents the sign of Scorpio. So Pluto and Saturn are aligned right now in what's called mutual reception. It's like Saturn is hanging out in Pluto place, right, in Scorpio, while Pluto is hanging out in the Saturn zone in Capricorn. And one thing that's very interesting too, in that 2012 to 2015 timeframe I mentioned of what's called the Uranus-Pluto square, those are the same years of Saturn's three-year transit through Scorpio. So there's just been a lot of energy exchanged between Capricorn and Scorpio. And I feel a lot of it is basically like, you know, the anger of the feminine who was stripped of this right to sit in the circle of grandmothers and to express her wisdom. And especially again with the death and rebirth of the goddess in Scorpio, which is kind of a specialty place for that. You know, it's on right now, and we're feeling that tension, and it's maybe hundreds and hundreds of years. So research I've been doing, it was interesting because when you reached out to me about having this talk together, I was deep in my software working on basically like the last 150 years of Venus's synodic cycle through these signs, because she makes this sacred pentagram, and that means basically she's exploring five signs at a time. Like after this Capricorn one, she'll move on to Leo, and that's been fixed for a little bit. But the pentagram also in retrograde is slowly moving through the signs. And what's very interesting to me is this is the last time that she will have this death and rebirth process in the sign of Scorpio until 2176. And it's been building since just about the time of the 19th Amendment being ratified by Congress. That was on August 20th, 1920. Is that right? I got to look that up again because it's been a second since I looked. But just after the time of the 19th Amendment being ratified, which of course is women's right to vote, Venus, two of the vertices of Venus's pentagram switched signs. And they moved into Aries and into Scorpio for the first time in like hundreds of years. And it's very interesting because in the traditional system, both Aries and Scorpio are related to Mars. So it was almost like, right, the woman gets the right to vote, and now she's like cultivating this power. And that's been culminating. And this time now, this very special time, with Venus's last death and rebirth initiation in the sign of Scorpio, to me is kind of like the culmination of all of that. So I think we're feeling a lot of that angst without, we're seeing it without, within, you know, and there's been this separation of yin and yang, certainly for a lot longer than 150 years, but it's very active right now, and we're seeing that now. And a lot of us are experiencing, you know, death and rebirth all around us at this time, and I think this is one of the key indicators of that.
So as you're speaking, I'm sort of seeing all these connections just lighting up. I mean, it's one of the things I really appreciate about what you do is you speak a very technical language, and yet in that it's bringing up all these feelings and all these thoughts in me. Musically, I'm interested in the connection. So you were mentioning that Pluto and Saturn were sort of, I forget what you, like this reciprocal relationship.
Yeah, it's called mutual reception.
So this mutual reception that's happening in those two signs, part of what I work with in the Tone Color Alchemy system is a tarot deck that was cultivated by Paul Foster Case of the Builders of the Adytum. And in that deck, you see in the Major Arcana, the Devil card, which corresponds to Capricorn, the Baphomet figure is holding up his right hand. And you can see in the creases of his palm the symbol of Saturn. The glyph of Saturn is there. And I've always had this sort of subtle connection in my mind between those two. And of course, Saturn in that system corresponds to the musical note A, and Capricorn also connects to the musical note A. Whereas you have Mars and Pluto both corresponding to the musical note C. And for those who are musicians in the audience, they'll know those are relative keys, C major and A minor. So I was seeing in that a sort of union of the solar and lunar energies musically. But also what was coming up for me with the introduction of the Venus cycle to this conversation is that, so with the crashing of Antares, for people who have seen that video, it essentially looks like a tower that pulls away for the rocket to then launch. And the rocket goes up maybe, I don't know, it looks like 100, 150 feet and then explodes in the sky. And so that brought up for me the image of the tower, which corresponds to Mars, but it's the image in the tarot of a lightning bolt coming down essentially from God, striking the tower and knocking the people from their comfortable place. And so there's flames and there's an explosion. And so with that musical note C and the introduction of that synodic pentagram, I was thinking of this theme by Gustav Holst, who actually created a fantastic orchestral piece called The Planets. And it's a suite of each one of the planetary energies represented. The Mars theme in particular is very interesting because it's written in a 5-4 time signature, which means essentially that instead of counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, the 1 comes back after 5. So that would be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And it's a very unusual time signature for Western music of that era. And rhythmically, what's happening essentially is you have a sort of a marching snare drum, which in itself is very martial or Martian, of the essence of Mars. But also the musical note that we're hearing there is G, if you listen to that piece by Gustav Holst. So I do want people to take a listen to it, but to remember that G is the musical note that corresponds to Scorpio. And of course, that's sort of tying in all of these themes of the musical note A and G and F sharp and C, all of these notes coming together. And so let's go ahead and take a listen to the Mars theme by Gustav Holst. Okay, again, that was the Mars theme by Gustav Holst. One of the other interesting things to think about with that piece is John Williams, who is the creator of the Star Wars soundtrack, admitted openly in an interview that he had taken his theme for the Imperial March directly from this Mars theme. And so I want to also feature that briefly so people can compare. So that's the Imperial March, and it's just fascinating to hear how musical styles get appropriated and reintroduced thematically. Star Wars, of course, being a song about this sort of warrior battle between these bodies in the sky, these spaceships. So the crashing of Antares, too, being the both the name of this rocket, but also the name of the heart of the Scorpio, for me reminds me of the sort of the breaking of one's heart or the cracking open of one's heart. And for me, that really is where the union of masculine and feminine is at its most potent. When you're with your lover and you're just in that space together, and there's this deep sense of intimacy, and all the barriers have been broken down, and that union is allowed to have happen.
Wow, Ezra, yeah, and there's so much coming in for me right now. One, that, you know, when we play music and we're playing in the key, in the time signature of 5-4, that we'll usually count 2 and 3 or 3 and 2. And so it brings us back to this Fibonacci sequence where 2, 3, and 5 are involved. But probably more importantly, first to address kind of the heart cracking open, you know, it's very much part of the Scorpionic initiation. There's a lot of passion in Scorpio. And it comes, you know, in the calendar after Libra. Libra's about relationships, so we're getting together, and then we open up and we know each other on a more authentic level. And this is really the intent of Scorpio, absolute authenticity in the emotional experience and expression. And so sometimes we can really open up and share, and then that can lead to the broken heart experience. But the great thing about the broken heart is it's the silliest term known, right? Because that heart is anything but broken. It's working quite well. It's working overtime, just as it does in that state of love's bliss. Mm. And in the Scorpionic quest, you know, there's something about getting to this point where we realize that things are not done to us, they're done for us. And in that sense, that sometimes after the trauma, the light can be the heart can be lighter than it was before the trauma. If we're undergoing the healing, the vulnerability required for that, and forgiveness and self-forgiveness and all of this. And this is part of Scorpio, of the phoenix rising from the ashes of the snake that sheds its skin. But what really came in is this idea of Antares, the rocket, looking like the tower, being on the tower. And what you mentioned about the tower card before, and I didn't know of its correlation to Mars. I often use that imagery, especially the one from the Rider-Waite tarot deck, when I'm speaking with people about a time when Uranus is very significant in their life, because astrology for years called Uranus the lightning bolt of change. And I love this image of the tower because, you know, most people know this card, or you could look it up on Google as you're listening. Just search Rider Tarot Tower and you'll see this image. But there's some amazing things happening here, right? We've got this tower that's on fire. We've got a crown flying away from it. We've got two people falling. But when I look closer, it seems to me that one is falling and the other dove. And the one that dove, like the fire follows them. It's this fire of will and spirit. And so in times of change and in times of Uranus, and Pluto transits work the same way, my big mantra is choose change before change chooses you, because the former is always prettier. And in the Scorpionic quest, you know, we can learn to surrender to action. We're evolution, byproduct of some demonic natural selection. The habitat gets so bad that you have to evolve to survive. But Scorpio and all the archetypes have this available, and we are all of these signs anyway, is my true belief in my practice. Something about getting past that, simply surrender to evolution when it forces you to, and learning to summon it. And so there's something about the one of the two of the tower card who dove, right? And he's kind of being rewarded because the fire follows the diver and moves away from the faller. And then we look at this card, and what caused the fire in the first place? Lightning, right? From the heavens. It's like the divine change here to destroy the tower that might not be a righteous tower, a false pedestal that must crumble so that we can righteously build our own.
And you know what comes up there too is that the destination of the Antares rocket, I don't think we mentioned that yet, but it was on its way to the space station with these, I think, hundreds or maybe thousands of pounds of equipment, and that it was unmanned. So there were no human casualties, but it was a major loss for this attempt to maintain our position in this sort of false tower.
Yeah, and you know, I don't know if we want to go this deep into it, but why not? You know, there's a lot of like the Aquarian age symbology in this event, you know, the unmanned rocket especially, you know, it's like this quest cosmos blast off, and the moon is in Aquarius right now. So there's this, you know, sometimes that doesn't agree with the ways of the heart in Scorpio. I mean, the shadow of Aquarius, it can be avoidance, you know, and in this thing called the moon game, and it's about really anchoring Scorpio intentions to purge its shadow and to anchor its light. And for Scorpio, the shadow might be secrecy and the light is absolute emotional authenticity. So if we're setting these intentions to really share in this week that began last night with the Aquarius first quarter moon, starting the second week of this moon process, in my game, it's the time of tension to the intentions we set. And there's this sense that, okay, yeah, I've set intentions to really share my emotions. And, oh, well, some of the tensions might come in because the person who I choose to share those with doesn't want to hear them and is out and avoiding and escaping, you know. And there's some of this sense, even in the balance of the yin and the yang, of the terrestrial and the celestial. And so I love this imagery and the synchronicity as it applies to my own moon game of basically the Antarctic. The heart of the Scorpion refuses just to blast off into the cosmos. It wants to have the heartfelt experience of the human vessel, of the monkey suit, you know? And so there's this explosive force between one that is just trying to get away and one that's really trying to do this thing. And so the unmanned rocket, I love that, and the tower and this Aquarius energy, which brings us to Uranus again, because Uranus is astrologically associated with the sign Aquarius since it was discovered in 1781. And that discovery, first of all, I mean, it's so crucial because Uranus was discovered by William Herschel in 1781, or we could say rediscovered, using the telescope. William Herschel also discovered infrared with the prism. So here, technology at this time of Industrial Revolution was extending our sensory perception beyond the senses, right? And so the solar system used to stop at Saturn because that's the furthest out planet that we can see with the naked eye. And now here is this new planet Uranus. And here is this new light that's not visible, infrared. So interestingly enough, William Herschel named Uranus George because that's who was paying his checks. And that fortunately only stuck for 3 days. But there's something now in this Uranus-Pluto square time. It's really the most significant astrological, astronomical alignment of our current time. This 2012 to 2015 Uranus-Pluto square, revolution, evolution teaming up. I mean, at times in history when these planets have gotten together in these alignments that are called hard aspects, French Revolution, American Revolution, Communist Revolt in Russia and China alike, you know, the whole fascist thing in Germany that led to World War II, the Vietnam, that was the last time they were aligned in this way. And so there's this evolutionary force and this revolutionary force kind of pulling on one another. And so, you know, in the tone color alchemy, it would be interesting to see what happens when we bring Aries into the mix, because that's where Uranus is now. And so we've talked Capricorn and we've talked Scorpio. And now I'm wondering what happens when we bring two other archetypes into the mix, which would be Aries, where Uranus is now, and also Libra, where Mercury is now.
Right. So
so I'd be interested in hearing the musical reflection. I can kind of tell you the rest of my piece of why I bring those in.
Yeah, I would love to. We're not introducing any new notes there. Aries corresponds to the musical note C, which is shared by Mars. And then Libra is connected to the musical note F sharp, which is shared with Venus.
And what about Mercury?
Mercury is corresponding to the musical note E, which actually connects to Leo. And of course, Leo right now, I believe, has Jupiter in it. Is that correct?
Yeah, and at this time of our talk, the Aquarius moon is in opposition to Jupiter and Leo, and they're both aligned to Saturn and Scorpio.
It really is musical. I mean, that's what's so fantastic about being able to explore this stuff together is talking to another person who's both a musician and an astrologer. I can tell that you can really appreciate the similarities between these mediums and the opportunities we have for cross-pollination between the disciplines.
Oh, absolutely. And the way that they feed each other and expand each other. I mean, you know, it's this thing, you know, I have this mantra of these many branches I'm called to climb all emanate from the same trunk. And as we find our way, even in like mythology, which is so much of my study now, seeing how these global myths all are telling the same story, there's something about finding them told by other cultures so that we can come back to some kind of original truth. It's an amazing experience. And to me, yeah, very much astrology, astronomy, which has been split from astrology for some reason, they need to remerge. And music is one of these glues that can help that process. So what you're bringing to, you know, this celestial world that I'm now spinning through is gift. I really honor you for that.
Thank you.
Is there a note for Uranus, Ezra?
Yeah, Uranus corresponds to the musical note E. So actually, there's a story that Uranus and Mercury are actually corresponding to the Fool and the Magician card, the first two cards of the tarot. Both of them have the color yellow and the musical note E. And so they're sort of octaves of one another.
Wow. Yeah. And so, you know, when you were mentioning A and C earlier, and then I think G came in, right? But I was really wondering where the E is going to come from to make that A minor chord. And so here we get it from, you know, this whole Mercury, Uranus, or Aries, and Leo situation. So the song's developing, but you know, the way that I see this supply right now is there is kind of this tension of yin and yang, of feminine and masculine energies that have been divided for so long, and they really want to come together. So, you know, Venus, as she's been undergoing this death and rebirth, and that whole kind of exchange of Mars's investigation of Libra, while Venus moved from Libra into Scorpio, Venus's investigation of Capricorn, while Mars moves from Sagittarius to Capricorn, they're also aligned in a very harmonic aspect, angular agreement that's called a sextile, a 60-degree alignment. So there's something speaking of, right, we're going through our tension, we've been divided, we want to come back together, how can we work it out, you know? And the other symbolism there is that Mercury, which went retrograde at the very early degrees of Scorpio on October 4th, dipped back into Libra, right? And so Libra is the sign that is about relationship and about harmony and balance. And so all of this energy that's happening that feels like it's torn us apart and there's these wounds to address, we find that the way to really heal them is not to stay apart and to perpetuate the division, but come together and to embrace. And for the masculine, of course, this means finding the feminine within and vice versa for the feminine, but for us also to come together, you know. And while I very much honor women's groups and men's groups, there's something about coming together at this time in humans groups, you know what I mean, in discussing the divide so we can end that mess and embrace one another again. And so I love that Mercury is kind of dipping back into Libra in retrograde, and that retrograde motion's, you know, one way it's speaking about getting out of the intellect and more into the intuitive self from the left to the right, but it's also retrograde, right? So it's speaking about backwards and speaking about maybe looking back into the past to clear some old wounds. And where Uranus and Aries really comes into this mix, you know, just before the Scorpio solar eclipse on October 23rd, we had the full moon lunar eclipse on October 8th, and it's what's called a blood moon, a total lunar eclipse. In fact, we're having four blood moons consecutively, the first one in April of this year, and then October of this year, and then next year in April and October of 2015. Four total lunar eclipses in a row, that's called a tetrad. It's super rare, and we could do a whole talk about that thing. But where I want to go with this is that, in a sense, Mercury got to Scorpio right around the place where the October 23rd solar eclipse would be. And on October 4th, Mercury turned around to go back into Libra. And as Mercury was moving back, the lunar eclipse on October 8th, it was the sun in Libra and the moon in Aries, right across the chart, which is a full moon position. That's when we have a lunar eclipse. But the moon was right with Uranus and right at what's called the south lunar node. And the south node speaks about the past. The north node, where the sun was, speaks about the forward direction of our collective consciousness. So we're at this time with north node in Libra, and this is all the way from, I think, February 20th 2014 until November 2015. It's kind of a long study pulling our attention back to equality, peace, balance, relationship, the Libra ideals. And so what I really saw happening at this time with Uranus being revolution, you know, in Aries, which is very much about the self. This is like the revolution of self. And so the moon is there, the lunar eclipse, you know, the symbolism here is the shadow of Earth bearing the moon, which in many ways references the heart, although in shamanic astrology we look to the moon very much as the definition of our lineage. You know, it's giving us the opportunity to go into the shadows of the heart as an exercise of the revolution of self. And it's of the fire, Aries, right? And this fire is spirit, but it's also the will. And so what I really saw happening at this time is it was to go back, look at the wounds, and reclaim any pieces of ourselves that we have given away. You know, and we do this a lot in relationship. And this is how Aries, Libra, which are polarity points, they're opposite signs to one another, they educate each other. I mean, Libra's saying, hey, we're here, were monkeys meant to pick the bugs out of each other's hair? You can't do it alone. Be in relationship. And Aries is saying, hey, we also have to be independent, right? Like, we're kind of coached to believe that independence is poison to balanced relationship. But with wisdom, we find, no, that's not true. It's the medicine. You know, two people can come together independent into themselves in a state of self-love. That's when there's a true opportunity for loving, expanded relationship together. And so what I was seeing at that lunar eclipse number 8, it was take back the stuff you've given away. When you lose yourself to relationship, the relationship is lost. And at what cost? You. So no more of that, right? Fire is the one element we can share without giving ours away, like others can light their candle from our own. But we do this, and we serve others' attentions in front of ours for the sake of diplomacy and the sake of peace, and we punch others' clocks and whatever. And it's like, nope, take back your fire, take back your will, and you will see how that actually serves relationship. And so that was this kind of October 8th lunar eclipse, and then it moves into solar eclipse on October 23rd in Scorpio, which is very much about the magic and the power of the authentic, open, awakened human heart. And to me, like, the entire exercise at this time is, okay, take back your fire. So there is a place for you to basically hold the alchemy, right, with the waters of the authentic Scorpio heart. And maybe that brings us into another card of the deck.
Potentially, it
which
also
would be temperance.
Well, temperance, which corresponds to Libra. So, well, I'm sorry. Libra is justice. Temperance is,
I think it's
art.
The Sagittarius.
Yeah, that's Sagittarius.
Card.
You're right. That's Sagittarius. Yeah, and that's the musical note G sharp. I also want to just bring in, you know, with the union of masculine and feminine, drawing sort of full circle back to the original point, there's the idea of this first track in Music for Airports consisting entirely of acoustic, an electric piano, and some synthesizer. But as he moves through the track, he begins to bring in female vocalists. There are actually three women and Brian Eno singing together and then creating these loops. And it was a really fascinating process how he actually created the pieces. It was very tactile in that way. And so I definitely want to bring in this piece just so people can hear it. I think temperance is a beautiful place also to sort of launch into the idea of, in Crowley's deck, you call it art, right? So the artful temperance of the masculine and feminine forces finding expression through music. This may actually be a good place too to wrap up for our first episode. I love having this opportunity to chat with you, man. And I'm really hoping that in the coming months we can continue to do this and explore various aspects of what's happening in the sky.
Yeah, absolutely. And just musically, I love that G sharp's come into the mix and we've got that tritone to the C and like a little bit of the tension, right? Or we've had the A7 chord happening and now there's that major seventh coming in. So maybe that takes us into the search for another song that can agree with this time too. And maybe we could start there next time.
Oh, that would be beautiful. Yeah, for G sharp. And G sharp actually corresponds not only to Sagittarius, but also to the High Priestess, which is the moon card. It's the High Priestess card, but it is the card which corresponds to the planet, the moon. And so, you know, we could be looking into the blue moon or the blood moon. Certainly the April blood moon was very relevant for me because that was the same week that I published my book. And there was a lot there. It was Passover during that time, which is all about the slaughtering of the ram and the painting of the door frames with the blood of the sacrificed animal. So the presence of the blood moon during that time was, especially since the moon was in Aries, it was a potent symbolic moment.
Yeah, you know, the last thing I'd share, because I know we have to stop at some point here and we could do this all night,
yes,
but watching that solar eclipse last week, you know, with my own eyes, my birthday is October 24th. Well, a lot of people ask me why I call myself Gemini Brett when I'm a Scorpio, but that's a talk for another time. But this just felt like a gift from the heavens. Like, I watched with my own eyes the moon eclipsing the sun. I saw with my own eyes a sunspot for the first time. Mm-hmm. But what came in for me is that the moon basically turned the sun into a crescent. And in the High Priestess card, especially in the Rider deck, there is that crescent sun that's at the bottom left of the card. And in that card too, you know, you have the pillars of Joachim and Boaz, right? But they're B's on the left and J's on the right. And my formal name is Brett Joseph. So in my soul number in some numerological systems is the 2, which is corresponding to the priestess card, right? So it was like another symbol that came in for me. It was like, wow, like at my birthday, I've got this solar crescent and like the BJ, and you know, I just stared at that card for a long time. It's pretty cool.
I hope you got a BJ on your birthday.
Well, in that way I did.
In that way. Beautiful. Well, let's end this then with another track from the Music for Airports by Brian Eno. Brett, thanks again for coming on, man, and I look forward to doing this again soon.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure, Ezra.
All right, brother. Thank you.